Blog Talk Radio.
This is Yasa Sagonige, a 7th grade grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. Folks, the scriptures say my people perish for lack of knowledge. We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Before he passed away in 1985, Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all 145 past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. We had a very close call at the end of last month. We almost didn't raise the funds that we needed to stay here on Blog Talk Radio. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look. OCO, Ginalee, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation.
has come to the Vietnam jungle. Rain falls into the wide open eyes of Captain Flynn and Corporal Miranda, sprawled in the mud there where they have died. And night has come to the children of China. They follow the lies of a false unicorn, and his madness is burning the minds of the children. Those children shall never be born. Sometimes I feel that it just can't be real. This world's in a spiral and spin, tumbling down after Beelzebub's laptop. Won't someone admit it's a sin? Playgrounds, popcorn, and pink cotton candy. Disneyland daytimes dance in the eyes of freckled-faced, t-shirted, milk-drinking babies who never have ever seen fire in the sky. Sometimes I feel that it just can't be real. This world's in a spiral and spin, tumbling down after Beelzebub's laughter. Won't someone admit it's a sin? Playgrounds, popcorn, and pink cotton candy. Disneyland daytimes dance in the eyes of freckle-faced, t-shirted, milk-drinking babies who never have ever seen fire in the sky. And I hope they never will.
Hello, everybody. This is your old buddy Blue Otter coming to you from an undisclosed location deep in the backwoods of Tennessee. Our guest this evening is Tom Chittum, author of Civil War II, The Coming Breakup of America. Here's a quote. America was born in blood. America suckled on blood. America gorged on blood and grew into a giant. And America will drown in blood. This is a specter that is haunting America, the specter of Civil War II, a second civil war that will shatter America into new ethnically based nations. And that's the opening passage of Civil War II, The Coming Breakup of America. And Tom, can you hear us?
I can, 5x5.
Okay, yeah. Good to hear from you again. You were our guest here in our home in the second week of April, and we had lots of fun, and I showed you around. I don't know. You know, I heard about your book years ago and never dreamed I'd meet you. And I don't know, you're just a regular guy and who had an interesting life. I've had an interesting life, and but you've got a real interesting take on things. I'll just let you tell your story, and you do it better than I do.
Okay, where do you want me to start with my book?
Yeah, just start with wherever you feel like you want to ramble. You know,
okay. My only real claim to fame, so to speak, is I'm the author of the book Civil War II that you mentioned, and it asserted that in due course, America would break up just like all other empires have, and it would almost certainly break up, not peacefully, but in a tribally based civil war, much as Yugoslavia did, where I fought in 91 and 92.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I'm on board with you because, you know, this show's about prophecy, and, you know, there's all kind of imagery in all kinds of scriptures, different places. I mean, war is just something that happened, and Americans, well, for instance, George Washington's vision at Valley Forge. People might be familiar with that, but in this vision, he saw that there would be a red fog that would come out of Europe, that would cover Europe one time, and then it would recede, and then it would cover Europe again. It would reach to the shores of across the Atlantic, all the way to the shores of the United States, and then it would recede. He said the third time, though, he said it would cover our nation too, and he saw that our nation would be attacked from four different directions, and that there would be a war in the center of our country that would be fought on three fronts, and he saw some kind of divine intervention. But yeah, you're right. You're a military historian, and I want you to explain to folks that this is where you're coming from. Is history, which repeats itself unless we learn. But we never learn from history, it seems.
Yeah, one thing I would like to say at this time is that most Americans understand that we're an empire based on our global military bases and our constant wars all over the globe. What they fail to understand is that internally we have the demographics of an empire. That is to say, we have three major, I like to call them tribal groups over here, whites, blacks, and Hispanics. And empires are not held together by kind words and love. They're held together by brute force and money. And if at any time any of the disaffected tribal groups within the empire sense that they can break away, they usually do.
Mm-hmm.
When empires encounter some great shock, like, oh, it could be a natural disaster, an economic collapse, or a foreign invasion, the disaffected tribal groups within the empire usually just try to cut off their own slice of the pie and say the hell with it and go their own separate way, just like the various tribal groups in Yugoslavia did. And I think that will be our eventual fate, probably within our lifetimes.
Yeah, it's kind of starting to look that way. I know. Now, I don't want to, you know, at first glance, if you put in Thomas Chittum, you know, you have a lot of skinheads and people talk about you, but you know, I want to underline, Thomas is not a racist. I mean, his book is also recommended by Jews for the preservation of firearms ownership, and other people too. You know, and you don't have any racial axe to grind here. You're just you know, taking a look at history and the racial divides and the gangs. I know there was one prophecy made about 1840 by a fellow whose church was under attack by a lot of different people, and they went to the United States government, and the president said, "I can't do anything for you." But he said that the United States would break up someday, and he said that it would begin first in neighborhoods. It would be neighborhood against neighborhood, then it would be town against town, county against county, state against state, and people don't understand that the first so-called Civil War was actually a war between two sovereign nations, but it's billed as a Civil War. But this next one, well, the first one was really an internecine war between brothers, but this next one's going to be a true Civil War. People need to understand, you know, what these terms mean, because history is written by those who vanquish and conquer.
Yeah, there's one thing I'd like to emphasize at this time. I'm not advocating this war. I'm predicting it. And I wrote that book to make people understand that unless we begin to perceive our problems in a new way, we won't solve them.
We're trying to prevent this.
Yes, that's why I wrote the book. That was my only purpose. I saw a tribal civil war in Yugoslavia, and it was horrific, almost beyond the ability of anyone to describe. And I don't want the same thing to befall America.
Well, and wherever you speak, you were a paratrooper in Vietnam. You knocked around Africa for a while, and fought as a volunteer down there, and found your way to Bosnia, and
Not Bosnia, Croatia.
Oh, Croatia, excuse me. And fought as a volunteer with the... But anyway, yeah, yes, go ahead and... I tend to ramble on too much. I'm a little amped up today because I drove to Nashville and back, just got back, so...
Also, it's been my stated policy from the very beginning that I would talk to any group or media outlet, irregardless of their racial orientation or their ideology or their religion, because this civil war we're going to have is going to be what you might call an equal opportunity war. Everybody gets a nice big slice, and we're all going to take a whack. So it's always been my stated policy to talk to anyone as long as they're civil to me, and I just tell them, don't expect me to agree with you. I'm a one-trick pony. I have my own perspective, which is rather unique, and that's what you get when you have me for a guest.
Well, I know we had long talks when you were here, and you're a very astute individual. Well, you know, people that write computer codes are pretty intelligent people, and you have a very quick mind. And I think when you and I were both young, you know, we probably had a touch of, you know, ADD or whatever they call it. I just know I was totally bored in school because I learned everything so fast, and my mind seemed to operate like a robot, and you kind of felt like, you know, that's the reason why you survived so many gunfights. But anyway, yeah, I guess people know by now I'm a fan.
Okay.
But, yeah, where do we go from here?
Well, right now, my main concern is the economic situation. I had one paragraph in my book that talked about or mentioned the consequences of what would happen if the American dollar loses its status as the international reserve currency, that if that came to pass, we would be instantly transformed into just another third world banana republic like Brazil, kind of like a banana republic without bananas, and the price of everything, especially imported goods, would go to the roof. A lot of people wouldn't have enough to eat, and if there is one rule of thumb of military history that everyone should be aware of, that young males will not accept starvation, they will fight.
Yep.
And that's what's going to happen. Moving on a bit, I want to point out to everyone that the most militarily unstable region of America is the Southwest, particularly Los Angeles. And I want to give a quick mini lecture on why Los Angeles is so militarily unstable. Now, if you look at Southern California, I call it the Los Angeles Basin. I don't know if it's a basin in geological terms. But in demographic terms, it's a huge basin about 100 miles by 80 miles long. It is huge. And if order breaks down there are so many gangbangers with so many guns that they would overwhelm the police in short order. And I want to contrast the situation in Los Angeles with riots that occurred in other parts of the country within my lifetime. These riots, in my perspective, were really not riots, but uprisings by disaffected imperial subjects, usually blacks. And the reason they were so easily put down is because disaffected blacks in the ghettos, that were usually a very small geographic area, maybe 5 by 10 miles wide, inner city ghettos. And if the local police couldn't handle it, they could always call in the white National Guard, who were basically all white guys, and they would enthusiastically and immediately put down these many civil wars simply because the defenders, in this case the blacks in the ghettos, had no appropriate military response. They were just overwhelmed and crushed within a matter of a few days. That will not be the case with Southern California. It's too huge. Even if they call in the California National Guard, I don't know what percentage of the California National Guard is Hispanics, but it's a lot.
Yeah.
And they will run the risk of the Hispanic National Guard not firing on their co-ethnics, but rather siding with the rebels. In that case, they would have to bring in the federal military. And even if the federal military did succeed in putting down this revolution in Southern California, what the next consequence down the stream would be that all the affluent and educated people would simply pack up and move. and that would include the wealthy Hispanics, and Los Angeles would be transformed into a huge smoldering Tijuana with all its infrastructure destroyed. It would be the first major portion of the United States to fall to Civil War II.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I grew up in Orange County. Well, I can see what would happen there.
The place is belly up out there. They've got no money.
Yeah.
It's basically a third world country now with a sort of veneer of wealthy people who live in Beverly Hills or other rich areas. They're in for a big surprise.
Well, yeah, and I had another thought. Keep going. When I get tired, I get fleeting thoughts, and I forget them right away. But I'll get back to it in a minute. Yeah, keep going, and I'll get back to what I was thinking about.
Here's my theoretical overview of how the war will actually proceed militarily. First of all, we'll have an economic collapse and hyperinflation. People won't have enough to eat, especially in areas where they have a great many poor people who are just hanging on, like in Southern California. It will burn. People will evacuate, the people with money, the educated people who hold the infrastructure together. And after that, it will probably spread to other major cities in the Southwest. Well, you'll see the same pattern. And then after that, it will probably spread to the South, which will become an unspeakable slaughterhouse of black versus white. And once again, I'm not advocating this. I'm predicting it. I saw the same thing happen in Yugoslavia.
Yeah, you sure did. It was nasty.
In the space of about 30 days, Yugoslavia went from a peaceful nation to one that was just completely embroiled in all-out tribal civil war with neighbor killing neighbor. While I was over there, the group that I was with was primarily Dutch guys who were volunteers like me. And as our scout and interpreter, we had a Croatian guy. And at the outbreak of the war, his parents were murdered. Their throats were slit and their bodies were thrown into their house, which was then burnt down. And he knew who did it. It was local Serbs who were their neighbors, and he had played with them as children. Overnight, it went from peaceful coexistence to absolute slaughter of women, children, and everything, just within a period of 30 days.
Yeah. Could happen here, too. It sure can. You know, all that would really have to happen is for the EBT cards to be turned off and... in a starvation situation, barring a lot of young people, people will just, after about 10 days, everybody just kind of gets lethargic and they just slowly starve to death. But the young guys, they'll pick up guns and they'll start robbing and looting and killing. And that scenario has played out time after time all through history. And yeah, you're right. And, it's sad because, maybe let's face it. The least popular courses in school was English and history. And everybody fell asleep in history. And it's really kind of sad. We've already got one caller. Do you want to ask folks to just hold off for a while, or are you ready to take a question?
I'll take a question, but I might have trouble hearing it, so you might have to repeat
it
to me.
Hi, caller. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I got you. Blue Otter. This is Jack Urban.
Oh, hey, Jack. How you doing? You got a question or a comment for Tom?
Well, yeah, this is a really interesting show, and I have to tell Mr. Chittum first that I haven't read his book, but from what I'm picking up from everything just so far, I really have to respect his view on things because, interestingly enough, there's talk in the money markets of today that in September the petrodollar is going to lose on the market. And if what he's saying bears out, it could be a very difficult time. I live out here in San Bernardino, so I'm right in the middle of
and Jack,
what he's talking about.
What did I tell you guys a couple of weeks ago that Spirit had told me, this is how I was going to sleep, things are going to happen in September.
Yeah. It's very interesting what he's saying. And as soon as he started talking about the L.A. Basin, I just about crapped myself. You know, I understand exactly where he's coming from.
And, folks, I want to really publicly thank Jack. Jack is one of our oldest and biggest supporters. If it wasn't for guys like Jack and a couple other people, there would not be Prophecy Keepers Radio. We've had upwards of 600 regular listeners, and maybe 20 have ever helped out. But the guys that keep us afloat is Jack and a couple other people, and I wanted to publicly thank you.
Thank you very much. But so my question is he aware? Let me see if I hope he's hearing this, able to hear this, because basically what I'm wondering about is. All right, we're over in the Straits of Hormuz. We're rattling sabers and saying that, Iran has nuclear weapons, which is a bunch of BS, because it's, again, just like it was in Iraq, it's about oil. It's all about oil. Iran is sitting on the world's largest reserves. But what they've been doing is, because they don't have any refineries, they've been selling oil off the market. And they've been taking in trade in other funds other than petrodollars.
Mm-hmm.
And they've set up an exchange, in essence, or a stock market where the basis for trade will not be the petrodollar. And that is what America has been built up on since after World War II,
mm-hmm.
and even before then. And so basically, we're going to be SOL. And what are his thoughts on this? Basically, as possible September. And does this sound like a possibility to him?
Thanks, Jack. Oh. What do you think, Thomas?
Okay, I would like to give you two mini lectures on how I view this situation. Okay. First of all, some time ago I wrote an article that I posted at Seeking Alpha about this situation with the petrodollar, looking at it from the point of view of Russia and China. They have formed a military, political, and economic alliance called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And its main purpose is, in my view, they are very unhappy with their ongoing military encirclement by American military bases.
Yeah.
They don't like it. And this encirclement is being financed by the money that we're borrowing from them.
Yep.
And they cannot allow this situation to continue with the petrodollar being used to finance their own military encirclement. At some point in time, they're going to have to either drop the petrodollar or accept American military dominance of the world. So I don't know about September. I can't give you a date. But it's an ongoing thing. Everybody can see it. People are dumping the dollar all over the world. And I say it's because they're tired of financing our military aggression against them. Okay, that's point one of this mini lecture. Point two is that most of your listeners have not heard of a gentleman called Halford Mackinder. Halford Mackinder was a British guy who was born about the time our Civil War broke out, and he died in 1947. And his major claim to fame that in 1904 he presented a lecture to the British Geographical Society, which was actually a military plan for the conquest of the world. And his view was that if anyone wanted to conquer the world, in his case the British Empire, the key to the conquering the world was Southern Asia, especially the area around Iraq and Afghanistan and all those stand countries that broke away from the Soviet Union. And the reason he said this was because at that time, British was essentially a maritime power, and in their view, they could easily control all portions of the world where they could project power based upon their naval superiority. The only place that was not subject to it was South Central Asia because it was so far inland, and he argued that if they could just conquer South Central Asia, then, in effect, they would have conquered the entire world, and they could set up an empire that would reign forever because no power or group of powers could succeed in defeating them militarily because they would simply conquer the entire world. And also, I want to say this about oil. It's not really about oil. It's about conquering the entire world. Every senior officer in the Russian and Chinese military is aware of Halford Mackinder's plan. Americans, almost no Americans ever heard of him, but senior military officers all over the world have, because he was the first person who actually drew up an actual military plan for the conquest of the entire planet. And I assert that his plan remains in effect to this day, and that's why we have such a great military presence in that very area. That's where our major military moves are being made, as a threat to South Central Asia. We're still on the same plan, and the Russian and Chinese know this, and they have formed a military alliance to prevent Mr. Mackinder's plan from being put into effect. Oil is a means to an end. It's not the end. They want to conquer the entire world, and obviously, if you conquer the entire world, you've got everything, not just the oil, but everything. Oil is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. Their real end is conquering the entire planet with their stupid American hillbilly cousins serving as a military muscle.
Yeah. Yep.
It's really a banker's war. It's about controlling the currency. The British imperialists, after World War II, gave up on the plan of actually having an actual out-and-out empire with the British flag flying here and there all over the world. Their idea of conquering the world was to conquer the banking system and have everybody dependent on them for money. They reasoned that if they could accomplish that, everybody would have to dance to their tune, and they're still trying to do it, and we're losing because people are dumping the American dollar. And what it comes down to, in my opinion, at some point in time, we're losing. We're losing this economic war. And at some point in time, we're either going to have to accept defeat or roll the dice with our 15 aircraft carriers and go for an all-out war against Russia and China. And I suspect we will lose.
Let me ask you something. If there were a geopolitical beginning to this war, could you envision it beginning in the Pacific?
I would guess that our main target would be China, because they're not going to back down.
The reason why I ask is back about 1920, there was a woman that was a Quaker woman that had a vision, and she said that World War III would begin. Well, she said there would be a World War I and II, then there would be conflicts between so-called Christianity and so-called Islam. And she said then there would be another world war that would break out in the Pacific. Anyway, go ahead. I'm just throwing in something in there.
Well, I would guess it's going to break out globally. What they call the arc of conflict, all the way from the Eastern Mediterranean, Eastern Europe, the Pacific, Southeast Asia. It'll be a global war. Where it'll break out, I don't know. China and the Pacific is as good a guess as any.
Yeah, and they've got a navy too. Yeah, see, people don't understand. You know, unless you study military science, and you know, I dabbled in it when I was in college. But it's like you said, you know, if it wasn't for our 15 aircraft carriers, we'd basically be a banana republic.
Another thing I'd like to point out, as in America right now at this time, we have millions and millions, tens of millions of people who are about one paycheck away from starvation, or one welfare allotment away from starvation. if we should lose this, our status as reserve currency, there simply won't be enough money to feed everybody. It'll be like a game of musical chairs. Some people are going to be left without chairs or food, to be more specific, and then all hell will break loose. Young males will not accept starvation. They'll go for it no matter what they have to face.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you've written some other. At some point, I'm sure you're going to make some recommendations for people what they should do, maybe where they should be and not be. It's like I used to say, you know, Prophecy Keepers is all about, you know, finding out prudence, you know, how to be in prudent places and with prudent things, and don't be shy.
Well. Looking at it from a purely military perspective, I think anyone who has the means to do so should get out of the Southwest. It's the most militarily unstable region by far. Probably the safest place to be is what I call the Tavistock safety zone, or the Eastern Establishment safety zone, and that would be the East Coast of America.
Mm-hmm.
The Eastern Seaboard, because that's where most of these big shots, that's where they historically come from, and they own the most property. That's where they hang their hat at night. That's their real home, not the flyovers, not the Southwest, not the South, but the Eastern Seaboard,
mm-hmm.
outside of the big cities, of course.
I know Joel Skousen's written a book, Survival Homes, and, you know, he likes Idaho and Washington, but he says in the East, he calls these safe places redoubts, and he says in the East, he says he believes the American redoubt of the East is right where I am. It's the Cumberland Plateau. He has good reasons for thinking that, but you know, weather and the kind of people that live here let me inject some things here.
Okay.
The Hopi prophecy says that eventually that there will be an invasion from Mexico, and that's part of the Hopi prophecy. Don't want to go into a lot of detail. I mean, it's just there, and I have some friends in the Southwest that this word Aztlan now has a negative connotation, but I mean Aztlan. Stretched all the way to Wisconsin. There's an Aztlan State Park in Wisconsin. These people, the Aztecs, they ranged all over North America. But these fellows are in Walsenburg, Colorado, and they established a Native American church, the Congregation of Aztlan. And then in the last 20 years or so, it's become a dirty word because it's being used by militant Hispanics, who are rattling sabers.
Yeah, well, one thing I mentioned in my book, by the way, I'm not bad-mouthing Mexicans. I'm strictly a military guy.
Sure.
Period. If there's an economic collapse in America, there will also be one in Mexico. And
sure.
There will probably be a change of government. The government will fall to radicals, either left-wing or right-wing, whatever. It doesn't matter. And they will be able to divert the attention of their people away from the internal problems by trying to reconquer the American Southwest. No country, no patriotic group of young men likes to see a large swath of their country stolen by foreigners, and that's their perspective on the matter. That is,
yeah.
That the Southwest is really and historically theirs, and they want it back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not bad-mouthing from that. I'm just pointing out that this is the perspective of patriotic Mexicans, and they have
mm-hmm.
as good a historical memory as anyone.
Sure.
And I think they will take it back.
I just spoke with Jaime O. Perez, who was a Mixteca medicine man, and he's run for mayor of El Paso, and we've talked, had a couple of interviews, and he's now running for Congress. But you know, I'll bet Jaime, he's sitting right down there on the border, and he'd probably agree with you. And oh, I was just looking at your Sergeant Skull's Field Manual for the Practical Modern Warriors, another book. What do you think of Dr. Kissinger, who said Henry Kissinger said that military men are dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns for foreign policy? Did you hear he got groped by the TSA this week because nobody seemed to know who he was?
Excuse me? Did I hear what?
Henry Kissinger got groped by the TSA this week. He was in a wheelchair.
He probably enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Nobody knew who he was. So he didn't get the special treatment. But, I thought,
Mr. Kissinger's attitude is pretty typical of the really powerful people who rule Western civilization. They couldn't give a flying F about ordinary people like you or me. We're just pawns to move around on their chessboard. And that really reflects his attitude, that quote of his.
Well, about 6 months ago, there was a purported interview of Kissinger. It's not been verified. But you know how people get when they get up in their 80s and 90s? And he's, he was telling it like it is in this interview. You know, it's up to you or people if they want to see if they can find the interview and read it. But, you know, he seemed to be right up front, and it almost had kind of a, I don't know, like he was almost looking for redemption a little bit or something. It was weird.
He's a strange dude. He's one of the most powerful people in the world. He shows up at every Bilderberg meeting.
Yeah.
And when Kissinger speaks, everyone should take note of what he's saying, even though probably 90% of it is lies and propaganda and so on and so forth. But if you read between the lines, you can get a lot of insight into the way these people think.
Yeah, I think if you look at Kissinger interview 2012. Some people are saying that it's a fake interview. It was posted in January. Who knows? It was supposedly Jordan Al-Ghad newspaper prints fake interview. It was titled Kissinger, Death is He Who Does Not Hear the Drums of War.
Mm-hmm.
And this piece is apparently based on an interview conducted by Alfred Heinz, reporting for an entity dubbed Global Research and subsequently translated to Arabic by Al-Ghad's Ala-Adin Abu Zaina. In it, Kissinger predicts an all-out Third World War taking place in the region, the result of which will see the American military taking over 7 countries in the Middle East, whereby Iran will tip the balance and create a situation where, and I quote, Israel will have to fight with all its might and weapons to kill as many Arabs as it can. Hopefully, if all goes well, half the Middle East will be Israeli. The article is also filled with quotes from the Kissinger interview that include, control oil and you control nations, control food and you control people, and of course, quote, if you're an ordinary person, then you can prepare yourself for war by moving to the countryside and building a farm. You must take guns with you as the hordes of starving will be roaming. And quote, our young have been trained well for the last decade or so on combat console games. It was interesting to see the new Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 game, which mirrors exactly what is to come in the near future with its predictive programming. And, you know, of course, it's been branded as a hoax, but it's like you said, it's right up the alley of what this the co-founder of military and political geostrategy, Sir Alfred Mackinder, predicted.
Yeah, well, one thing I would like to point out is that the reason we are currently maintaining this global military aggression is because of our navy, we have 15 aircraft carriers, and if the Russians and Chinese can send these to the bottom of the ocean, they will strip us of our global military dominance instantly. We cannot maintain our global military dominance without those 15 aircraft carriers, and we know it, and they know it. If we lose them, we're just another third-rate power like Brazil or, I don't know, take your pick, South Korea, whatever.
Yep.
We won't be a global military power if we lose those 15 aircraft carriers. So that, I am sure, I would bet my life against a donut that that will be their first target if the balloon goes up, those 15 aircraft carriers.
Yep. Well, of course. Yeah, they'd be nuked. And, you know, shortly before you visited us, I think, back in March. I like to watch Fox, and I also like to watch Current TV. Current TV was running. You might be. I'll bet you could find it on YouTube. It was a program called South of the Border, and it's about what's going on down there. But Bush went and visited several presidents of South American nations, and
Which
the president of Bush too.
Okay, Bush, too.
And he told the president of Uruguay, who this president was interviewed, and he said that George W. Bush told him that the plan for economic security for the United States of America was continuing war.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's, I can believe that in a minute. We have no... We're an extortion racket. We're like the Capone mob. Either you hand over your goodies or we throw a bomb through the window of your store.
Yeah, well, you know, Argentina, they were going through all kinds of inflation and problems. They got out of the banking system, and they're thriving. You know, Bolivia's doing this. I mean, there are countries, and, you know, there are prophecies that say that the economic future rests with the Southern Hemisphere. They're going to be the next big dominant power in the Western Hemisphere, and... And they're divorcing themselves slowly from the banking system and the banksters. But I recommend everybody watch South of the Border on Current. I'll check YouTube and see if they're if they've got it there. It's really worth watching. And you know, I'm not really conservative. I'm a libertarian. But you know, you're stupid if you don't. In your search for information, look at what both sides are saying. Yeah, it's a liberal channel, but wow, that was a real eye-opener.
Yeah, right now there's a great debate going on about what China is intending to do and what their status is and how much power they really have. And I'm really impressed by what the Chinese are doing economically. I'm not talking about their internal laws or their morals or their form of government. I'm talking strictly about their economic policy.
Mm-hmm.
And they are on a roll.
Oh, by the way, I did find it. It was Oliver Stone that went. It was a CBS talked about Director Oliver Stone, who went and explored the political and social things that are going on. But yeah, if you want to go to YouTube and Google South of the Border Oliver Stone, you'll find and be able to watch this. But I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, well, back to China. I assert that at this time, China is really the leading industrial nation in the world, not America. They have a stated plan that they intend to become the major high-tech manufacturing nation in the world. And
sure.
They're putting that plan into effect. They're not pulling rickshaws and planting rice anymore. They're building nuclear reactors by the dozen. They are going to become the low-cost producer of high-tech scientific equipment in the world. They are going to displace America. They're doing it right now.
They got entire cities that are built just sitting there just ready to go for new industry. I mean it's long been known they've had a 500-year plan for dominating the world.
Well, my point is they're doing it. And it was,
sure.
There's a kind of joke I told. I was interviewed by a radio station, another blog talk station, about 2 weeks ago, And I said that someday we're going to send the Chinese government a short statement and saying, dear Chinese people, we have declared war against you effective immediately. P.S., could you please send us some spare parts for our high-tech weapons?
Yeah.
Because our military supply chain reaches all the way back to China. All our high-tech weapons are full of spare parts made in China. We have no more rare earth manufacturing or mining facilities left in North America. They have it all.
Our special operations teams, I mean, we're contracting with Norinco, you know, for weapons. And my gosh, they're probably making most of the uniforms that we're wearing. They're making it all. Yeah. It's hard to find anything made in the United States. I think there's only a couple of, you know, maybe Henry Arms and High Point are still making guns in this country. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Walmart, I mean, my wife's got a real thing about Walmart. She really feels that, well, you know how it was in Walmart, it was first getting started. Made in America, you know, and boy, they sucked us in on that one. And, you know, I know this happened after Sam Walton died. And, I know people who knew Sam when he was, you know, buying up railroad cars that had derailed, and, you know, and he had a storefront store in Springfield, and he stopped by for coffee, a friend of mine's house. A friend's about 70 now, but, you know, he's a mixed blood Cherokee. He was a good guy, but his dilettante children, you know, they're, what do they say, they've got more money than, I've heard figures bandied about how much money the Walton kids have got.
Oh, an incredible amount, I'm sure.
Got a question for you from our friend Mark the Badger Borcherding. He's our... If you want to know why you're here and why you do certain things and what your destiny is, he's the guy. But he wanted to know, have you read about Chinese ports of entry in the USA right now?
What I do about China, they're on a global shopping spree. They're buying up natural resources, farmlands,
mm-hmm.
mines, oil, you name it, all over the world, including here in North America and even America. And they're not going to stop. They want to be the leading manufacturing nation in the world, and they've got the bucks to put their plan into effect, and they're putting their plan into effect even as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
We are losing, hands down, plain and simple. And ultimately, the only option we'll have is the military option. Roll the dice with our 15 aircraft carriers and hope we can defeat them, and I don't think we can do it. I think we'll be biting off more than we can chew, although who knows what will really happen.
Well, yeah, they got, what, four times as many people as we do? I read a book back in 82 by Rene Neuberger. It was the title of the book's kind of a misnomer, but basically it was called Nostradamus Predicts the End of the World. It was really how he predicted World War III. And I recommend people read that book, because I was telling my buddies in the Guard out in Oregon back then, I said, hey, very soon we're going to become allies with Russia. I said, the wall's coming down. Oh, I was laughed to derision. And 5 years later, it happened. But basically, the book, the way Neuberger interpreted Nostradamus, he said that something would happen in the Indian Ocean that would cripple India's ability to, with their 800 million man militia. He said basically the only thing standing between the world and China crossing the Karakoram Highway and invading Europe is India and Pakistan. But he said something very dramatic would happen. Earthquake, tsunami, or something would happen in the Indian Ocean, and it would throw India into a position that would leave the door wide open for China to invade, and that they would link up and ally with the Muslims, and they would invade Europe, and it would be and Nostradamus also predicted that the sitting ruler of the royal line that eventually went down to Monaco, his name would be Albert, and when he wrote the book, Rainier was prince, but Albert is now Prince of Monaco, and they fight with NATO along with Italy, and Albert is still of military age. What, in his 50s? So it seems to be right on track, and this is before anybody ever thought about. But then we've been watching this takeover, literally, of Europe, but it's not been an overt military takeover of Europe. It's been an infiltration.
Well, I would like to make some comments about that.
Sure.
First of all, I think that if you look at the big picture, our former allies are jumping ship because they don't want to be sucked down with the losing American empire.
Mm-hmm.
A few days ago, I read an article that Japan, South Korea, and China are planning to set up a free trade zone. And what that amounts to in real terms is Japan is jumping ship. They don't want to be sucked down in this vortex of war. I don't think Europe will. I think Europe will jump ship too. Their main economic connection right now is with Russia. That's who's supplying them with most of their natural gas and other raw materials. I don't think they'll be willing to fight to death to save America's ass, to put it bluntly. I think we're going to be left all alone by ourselves. And I think eventually that the bankers in London will also kick us overboard and help the destruction of the American dollar as a world reserve currency and work out some kind of deal with Russia and China. That would be my guess. It could very well work out differently, but that's the way everything looks to me at this time. We're going to be left all by ourselves.
Yep. Barring some kind of unseen cosmic, you know, something coming from outer space, that's pretty much the way it's going to come down.
Russia and China are not going to stand for this much longer. They know perfectly well what's going on, and they know perfectly well that we're still following the plan of Halford Mackinder, that World War III is really going on right now, being fought mostly by proxy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to point out one other interesting thing that I picked up on that no one else did, and it's about Syria. They're having one of those phony baloney color revolutions that was stirred up by the Western powers. And the notable point is that both American military personnel and Russian military personnel were both there in Syria. Here we have a country and that's having a shooting war, and you have both American military personnel there and Russian military personnel there, and they may have been very well shooting at each other. Maybe Russians and Americans are shooting at each other right now in Syria. And these proxy wars all throughout history have a way of getting out of hand. I think that the Russians have drawn a line in the sand and say, no, you can't have Syria. We'll fight for it.
I saw Medvedev on Russian TV threaten to nuke us. You can see it on YouTube. And, you know, it's like, huh, you know, hey, don't mess with us. We'll just nuke you. Russia, hey, they're getting real cocky. But you do not hear about this in our media. We are sitting ducks.
Russia and China will not accept defeat. They're not going to give in. Because they know that if they give in, they'll be slaves to the Western banking system. And they're bound and determined not to let it pass. That's why they have formed this military alliance called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which most Americans have probably never heard of, but it's a major player, it's a major factor in the world. They're standing back to back, and I don't think we'll be able to split their alliance because they know that as long as they stand back to back against the Western powers, there's nothing we can do about it short of rolling the dice with our 15 aircraft carriers. We're losing, plain and simple. The economic tide and the military tide is running against us. The clock is ticking, We either go to war or we become another banana republic, plain and simple.
Do you know who Captain Eric H. May is?
I've heard of the gentleman. My publisher of my book is an associate of his.
Right. He just sent out a communique saying he expects a late May U.S. false flag likely. And so you can expect to see that. That just came over rumor mill news. And, yeah, there's a lot of strange things been going on with NATO, all kinds of rumors. And, you know, a friend of mine who lives here in Tennessee, and I won't say his name, but I will say that he was part of the emergency services constellation of Nashville. He told me back when the Prince of Darkness, Bush's vice president, was to visit Nashville, that he went to a briefing. And he was told that they planned, he says, in the 3 days prior to this guy's visit, I forget, who was Bush's vice president?
Oh.
Brain fart.
What's Cheney?
Cheney.
Cheney?
Cheney. He says the 3 days before Cheney's visit, they said they were going to crank up the power on all the cell towers. And he says that would get everybody all amped up. And he says that the day he arrives, we're going to turn it back down. Everybody will just feel zapped. And so, you know, hey, you know, they're using every means they can to manipulate people, you know, right up to electromagnetic radiation.
Well, the Chinese and Russians do have means to reply to this. They have nuclear weapons and they have art machines of their own.
Yep.
There's no way that we can cram anything down their throats. They have means to reply, and they will do so if we roll the dice with our aircraft carriers. There's no way that we can achieve, in my view, a straight-up military victory over them. They will not accept defeat without first rolling their own dice with their own ICBMs and heart machines. It would be a global disaster. It could end civilized life across the entire planet if both sides cut loose with everything they have.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Everybody's jumping ship. We're going to be a very lonely empire.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're doing the same thing to us we did to them, economic warfare. That's how we, if the Soviets ever really did, if the Soviet Union, you know, it's like, what, the fourth or fifth time they pulled this disappearing act where they claimed Glasnost, and they didn't go away. They just declared bankruptcy for a while, and they've just been laying low and building up. And, you know, hey, they're back. But, you know, the American public, I mean, we don't know. We're just told, you know, stand in line, you know, consume, shut up. Consume, shut up. Keep your mouth shut. You know. Just I mean, what's the first thing George Bush told us? Oh, please, please, please don't stop buying stuff on 9/11. Please don't. No. Just, you know, ignore the man behind the curtain, you know. Just please don't stop buying.
I don't think it's a plan that's going to work, because to buy things we have to have the money to do so, and we're quickly running out of that. We're in hock to everybody. We have to borrow money from our enemies to finance our global military aggression. I don't think that's a sound game plan.
Yeah. Because sooner or later they'll come. You know, I'll come right out with it. When I was living briefly in Oklahoma City back in 98, 99, we just had to escape Utah. I mean, I was there way too long. And but anyway, I had a dream that I was downtown Oklahoma City, and Chinese troops. But you know how they march in their parades. I mean, these guys were marching down the street in Oklahoma City, brand new Class A uniform, brand new shiny AK-47s. I mean, they brought out the Carnauba wax. And if you even looked at these guys, they'd level a gun at you. It was scary. It was one of the scariest dreams I've ever had. Got my attention.
Well, I don't know if any Chinese troops will ever make it to American soil. To me, that's, I don't know, no neither here nor there. The real action is going to be this, an all-out, at least conventional war,
yep.
Almost certainly followed up by all-out war with ICBMs and heart machines. That's what's terrifying me, and this whole thing will be set off beforehand by an economic collapse here in America, and I'm terrified of it. There's just so many people in America who simply are living off of the largesse of the greater society in the whole world. We're a welfare nation. We're a mixture of welfare and extortion. It's just not a sound economic game plan. If you don't make things, you either have to beg, borrow, or steal things. And it's getting to the point where we can no longer beg, borrow, or steal.
And then we've got word that an unnamed CIA source has leaked that over the next few months there's going to be 10 to 30,000. And when I say Spetsnaz, I mean, these guys are trained from childhood. They speak English with a Nebraska accent, which is no accent at all. These guys are every bit the warriors that SEALs are, but, I mean, they're going to take up... Well, they're at Fort Carson right now. They're not even part of NATO. They're practicing taking over Denver Airport. You know, and these guys are going to have permanent party on our top military bases. You know how easy it would be for these guys just to put on American uniforms, and they would totally blend in. It would be like, you know, and it's a big army. You know, who knows who's what? And if they come up, they've got orders, and they talk like Americans. I mean, this is how republics are brought to their knees, is by conspiracy. This is the way it happened in Rome, and the way it's going to happen here if history repeats itself.
There's a little-known story about Vietnam. I read about it in one of the after-action reports about a battle that I was personally involved in, and we had a great deal of problems with people breaking into our radio net, speaking in perfect American accents, trying to redirect our artillery fire onto our own positions. People speaking with American English accents. They do have these people. How many they have, I don't know, but they existed as far back as the 60s, and I'm sure they still got plenty of them today. That's one of the hallmarks, if you will, of these Spetsnaz. I'm not sure how to pronounce them, but they're the Russian special forces, essentially.
Yep. Yeah. We don't train our soldiers from, you know, age 6 or whatever. I mean, these guys are taken from their families, and they are raised as warriors. And a lot of them die in training.
I read about them. They're really tough guys.
Mm-hmm. My cat says he agrees. He's here crying. He says, right. How you doing, Georgie? I've been gone all day. He's very needy right now. Yeah, George is a good boy. He's mama's little athlete. My wife's in the hospital, and after the first night, I woke up the next morning, he brought in 2 chipmunks and the rear half of a rabbit, plopped them in her shower. And then I looked the next day, and the rear half of the rabbit was gone, but the chipmunks are still in there. So I don't know what he's doing. I guess he's just letting them get tender or something. I don't know what cats do. Oh, they're bloodthirsty little suckers, aren't they? So. Well, you met George when you were here. He's quite the swinging. And anyway, well, I'm getting full of myself here. I'm really tired. I'm really kind of slappy, so you'll have to excuse me tonight. So, but yeah, it kind of doesn't look good, and it's just like. A friend up in Canada, Bruce Beach, you know, number one, two, and three priority. Get out of the cities, get out of the cities, get out of the cities.
Yeah, I don't really know how the establishment views an internal war here in America. There exists a possibility that they might kick it off themselves in order to deflect blame away from themselves and onto various tribal groups to get the people of America to perceive each other as enemies to deflect the blame for the situation for themselves. That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. Maybe they'll try to suppress it. I don't really know, but it's a genuine possibility that they might set off a tribal war here in America to suit their own ends.
Hey, the Romans did it. Divide and conquer. They eventually came around and bit them in the butt I'm sitting here going through Eric May. I can't believe what a active blogger this guy is. My gosh, I think he's written 200 or 300 articles. I mean, one every couple of days. It's like, whoa. Started in August of 2007, and he's been blogging 2-3 times a week. Wow, this is interesting. Wow.
Yeah, there are a lot of disaffected people within the military. Our military may shatter if we have it certainly will shatter if we have an all-out tribal war here in America.
Oh, yeah.
I would like to point out one thing about how the Soviet Union ran their empire. They had a special military formation which was not in the normal military chain of command. And the sole purpose of these huge military formations was to put down ethnic uprisings within the Soviet Union. For example, if there was an ethnic an uprising in a Russian area, they would bring in Asiatic troops to put it down. On the other hand, if there was a military uprising among Asiatics, they would send in Russian soldiers from this special group to put it down. And they did this because they knew for a fact that soldiers are reluctant to open fire on their co-ethnics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the central problem our military will face here if we have an all-out tribal warfare that our military will almost certainly shatter into various and side with their own tribal group as opposed to siding with the federal government. We're not structured right here to put down an internal military uprising, and I'm not sure the people up at the top realize how serious this problem is. They're not taking the necessary steps to restructure our military to put down an internal tribal civil war. My fear is that if there is an internal civil uprising here, the cat will get out of the bag, and the powers that be will completely lose control, and things will play out irregardless of what any cooked-up plan that they have. And I've said this several times publicly, that if we do have an all-out tribal civil war here, it will be an absolute disaster of unprecedented magnitude. It could depopulate all of North America by 80-90% because the whole economic machine will break down.
Yep. Yep. Well, I recommend everybody. Now, I want to preface this with back when you wrote Civil War II, you know, you really weren't aware of the New World Order. This is really wasn't on your radar back then. And there are some things you may have a little. A lot of people are saying, "Hey, you got to write another one," you know. But your book really has made some waves. It's a real eye opener and. I recommend everybody read it. It's a really interesting read, particularly about where you predict the lines will break down, and you don't want to be within artillery range of certain places in the South, and based on the demographics.
One thing I'd like to point out, based on my experiences in Yugoslavia, we're not set up militarily here to handle an internal civil war. Here's what happened in Yugoslavia. The place was full of military bases.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every town of any size had a military base, but the problem was they were not fire bases. They were essentially ammo dumps and warehouses. The first military base that fell to the rebels was the town of the one in the town of Perusik, where I was stationed. The military base that fell, it wasn't really a fire base. It was surrounded by a chain link fence, and inside were all sorts of machine guns, rifles, uniforms, you name it. But they didn't have a defensive perimeter. It was essentially a supply dump. And what the local Croatians did was they had enough stolen rifles and whatever that they set up an attack force on a hill that overlooked this military supply base, and they rained down sniper fire on it. The Yugoslav Army defenders inside simply couldn't move from building to building or set up an effective defense, and they had to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
Also, about the Battle of Perusik, there was a Muslim sergeant inside this military base who secretly sided with the Croatians, and on the morning of the attack, he told all the Serbian soldiers, he said, "Look, guys, you've been working too hard. I'm going to give you a day off. Everybody who wants to can go over to the high school gym about five blocks away and play basketball all day. And one thing Yugoslavs like to do is play basketball. It's practically their national sport for reasons that I don't understand." So about half the Serbian soldiers took off and went to the local high school gymnasium and started shooting hoops. The base had almost no defenders. And the Serbs at the high school couldn't get back to the military base because of these snipers. They would just be cut down like stray dogs, and that's exactly what happens. The military base fell. The local Croatian militia all of a sudden had access to heavy weapons, machine guns, RPGs, you name it. A few days later, another military installation at the town of Gospić suffered the same fate. They didn't have a defensive perimeter. It was just another huge supply dump, and inside that one, it was a real honeypot. They had tanks inside that place. The same thing happened again. They didn't have a defensive perimeter. So the Croatians just rained down sniper fire on them. They couldn't move around the military inside their military base. Their tanks did them absolutely no good. The soldiers couldn't even get inside the tanks without being shot dead. So they took that military base, and then all of a sudden they had about 20 or 30 tanks that they could use. This was a pattern that happened all over the Croatian areas of the former Yugoslavia. And the same thing is going on here. If you look at our National Guard armories, they're not fire bases. They're just honeypots waiting for the first even halfway of military effective force to loot them. And that's exactly what
happen. Can you imagine this scenario? When I was in the State Guard out in Oregon, it was my job, if the Federal National Guard left town, it was my job, along with a former Marine sergeant and my wife, to take over the Tigard Armory. It was like, you know, hey, that's your, you know, that's your state defense forces. There was 1,100 guys, all volunteers, bought your own uniforms. We didn't even have weapons until the Oregon State Police decided they were going to get rid of all their old Mossberg 500s and we inherited them. But I know a sergeant major in the Tennessee State Guard that was Joe Tishia. He was been raising hell because you know, the state guards are not armed. We've been relegated to communications and other missions. And they said, you know, hey, Alvin York, he established the Tennessee State Guard during World War II, and he made damn sure we were armed.
Yeah, I would encourage all your listeners to go around and just visually look at a lot of these National Guard so-called military bases. They are not fire bases. They don't have a cleared field of fire around them. All they got is a chain link fence with houses and all sorts of other buildings smack right up against them that can be used for snipers to rain down fire inside of them. They're just honeypots of weapons waiting to be seized. The federal government, if they want to hold this country together, should consolidate these bases and turn them into fire bases to make sure that any rebels cannot seize these honeypots of weapons. And once again, I'm not advocating this war. I'm trying to prevent it.
Well, you know, I've been in a lot of National Guard armories, and I'll tell you, all they are, they're built just like average elementary or high school. The same kind of locks on the doors. They might have, I know the Tigard Armory had a bank vault that could probably be opened with 50 cal. And it was so funny because the National Guard gave orders for every security battalion to assign people to be shepherds for these armories. And it was my job for Tigard. And my CO had been ordered for some time to send somebody, and he hadn't done it. So my S3, who was operations and security, and I was a training officer and assistant operations and security officer, he said, go on over and do it. So I went over and did it. And, I mean, it didn't even show any ID. I mean, the janitor let me in, and, you know, he says, oh, do you want the combination to the armory? I said, no, I don't think that would be necessary. I was just over there counting windows and doors, trying to figure out how we were going to secure this thing. And then, I got called on the carpet because, the CO, had not let somebody, he had not let the Armory National Guard CO know that I was coming, even though he was under orders to do it. And he was threatened that this guy says, if you do something like that again, I'm going to see to it you're busted back to private and you're cleaning latrines with a toothbrush. and I got reams for this. I was following orders. And later on I figured out that my major's way of lighting a fire under the lieutenant colonel that was running the it was a real circus. It was like F troop.
Well, a lot of National Guard units are like that.
Yeah, well, this is a state guard. This is the 26 states still have state defense forces, and I ran into a guy that was in Special Forces First Group on Okinawa during Vietnam. And his grandfather had been commanding general 6th Army, General McCormick. And my friend's name was Grant McCormick Angel. And this guy had 13 air medals, 2 bronze stars, silver star, you know, bona fide hero. And when he got back, he was wounded 3 times. So got shot in the foot. And so they sent him home. And he came back to Portland and got a commission. And He finished up at the National War College, mustered out, came back, got a commission in about 69. And when I met him in 81 or 2, he was a major. And he was on the general staff, and he helped me get a direct commission, even though I was non-prior federal military. But I had, you know, my education, you know, which was in volunteer manpower management, and I had ROTC, and, you know, I did have some military training, and but it was a real interesting experience. And I tried getting in the Tennessee State Guard here, and I think they saw me coming. It was an interesting experience here. Made some people, pissed off some people here that they didn't let me in. They had a lot of excuses, like my weight. Well, there's no weight restrictions here in the Tennessee State Guard. It was, you know, I'm old school, and I know the difference between, you know, what a State Guard should be and what it ain't. And I wasn't making a lot of noise, but somehow I became, I don't know exactly what happened. I got my suspicions, but it's a mess. It's a real mess.
I'd like to tell you another story about the Battle of Gospic, which is a town of, 20, 30,000 people, I'm not sure. It was a good-sized place. It wasn't no village. And there was a major military base there that I told you the Croatian rebels took from the Yugoslav army.
Uh-huh.
And while I was there, I was with a Croatian army detachment that was moving in convoy through Gospic. And we passed through this one district, that was just completely leveled. It looked like Hiroshima after the atomic bomb blast. There wasn't a single brick on top of another. It was just leveled block after block after block. And I asked the Croatian guy, what the heck happened here? And the guy said three words, was Serbian district. They were ethnically cleansed, and they were ethnically cleansed even though this Serbian district was just within a few blocks of a Yugoslav army garrison that had about 30 tanks inside of it. You can't count on the federal government to protect you in those circumstances, mm-hmm. even though they have 30 tanks a few blocks away. You will have to defend yourself with what you have on hand, in your own hands, in your own house. You can't count on some outside military force protecting you. It didn't work in Yugoslavia, and it won't work here. They've got to change the structure of these National Guard armories, and they, the quicker the better, or they're going to pay a heavy price if the balloon goes up.
Well, refresh everybody's memories about who was on what side, who were the Serbs, who were the Croats, who were the Yugoslavians. You know, remind us, because, you know...
Okay. I'll give you a brief history as told to me by the Croatians themselves. Yugoslavia, literally translated, means South Slavs. There were three primary tribal groups over there, the Serbians, who were the most numerous, and the Croatians and the Muslims. And historically, they have never gotten along. Every time they get a chance, they go for each other's throats, and they've been doing this for a past at least 500 years. After World War II, when Tito was in power, he had a policy of suppressing instantly any nationalistic tendencies. For instance, this one Croatian officer told me that if you were caught singing a patriotic Croatian song, the secret police would come to your house and take you away and beat the shit out of you, if not put a bullet in your head. Tito passed away, and here's what the Croatians told me, the reasons they went to war. Over in Yugoslavia, the best job anybody could get would be was as an officer in the Yugoslav army. They got all the best money, the best housing, the most prestige. It was like IBM and Microsoft and all our big corporations all rolled into one. And after Tito died, here's what happens. The Serbians, who were the most numerous, started purging all the Muslims and Croatians from the officer corps. And when that happens, that was the final straw as far as the Croatians were concerned. And another Croatian officer told me, these were his exact words, I remember to this day, everybody knew there was going to be a war, so I stopped smoking and started jogging. Everybody knew it was going to happen. It was no secret. And it all exploded in the period of about 30 days. It went from a completely peaceful nation to all-out tribal slaughter. And the same thing could happen here. Always, I suspect it will be a lot more longer and drawn out.
Yep. Yep, could happen.
I mean, there was no secret. It's just the way it was. They also had a hyperinflationary collapse prior to the outbreak of the war.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same old problem with an empire. They're not held together with kind words and love. They're held together with money and brute force. One time, I was doing a little, I was looting, okay? Looking for souvenirs would be a polite term, but I entered this one house, and all over the floor were literally hundreds of Yugoslav currency notes. I think they call them dinar. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But they were in denominations of 10 and 20,000 dinar. It looked like Fort Knox inside there, like a bank. I mean, you couldn't. They were all over the floor. So I scooped up a whole bunch of them, thinking I was a rich man. And I showed them to the local Croatians, and they just laughed because the money was worth nothing.
But
they had
been
a hyperinflationary economic collapse just prior to the outbreak of the war.
Well,
it was
they
like
have
musical chairs, or was there enough money to go around, so everybody started fighting. Everybody, all the ethnic groups decided they'd better carve out their own piece of the pie, because that was the only option they had left.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least they had a reliable source of toilet paper.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. There you go. Just about the best outhouse wallpaper. I know my dad, there was only one thing, two things I wanted from my dad. Was his father's watch. It was just a cheap, pocket watch. But granddad was born in Sweden. And yep. He had a huge, I didn't have it when you were here because it was, my friend in Utah had it because it was in storage. But it was a picture frame, probably about 4 foot by 3 foot of historic currencies. And one of these currencies was the Zehn 1000 Deutschmark, the Deutschmark that was out during the hyperinflation. And apparently the person that engraved the note knew that it was going to happen, and they didn't catch it before it got into circulation. And it was a picture of a worker with great big bulging muscles in his head was turned heroically, and if you look real close, you can see a ghoul sucking his blood right at his jugular vein.
Well, I guess the guy saw it coming.
Yeah. I can imagine what his fate was. But, but he had all kinds of other, Confederate currency, all these currencies. He also collects stamps, and it was interesting, but that's all I wanted. And see, I was weaned, and from the time I was 8-9 years old on, none dare call it treason, none dare call it conspiracy. And my dad worked in national defense, so I was always hearing the stories.
There's one other thing I'd like to point out, a similarity between Yugoslavia and America, and that's demographic patterns. In Yugoslavia, the three major ethnic groups had areas in which they were concentrated. The Croatians were concentrated in Croatia, of course, and the Serbians in Serbia, of course, and the Muslims in Bosnia. But on the border areas between them, there were wide areas where you had mixed populations, and that's where the most horrific fighting took place, because it was literally neighbor against neighbor. In the areas that were predominantly a one ethnic group, there was very little fighting because everybody was on the same side. And this same demographic pattern exists in America. You have areas that are predominantly black, predominantly white, or predominantly Hispanic, but you also have areas that are highly mixed. This is where the most intense, horrific personal fighting occurred. It's similar to what we had during our Civil War, like in Missouri, where like half the people were on the side of the Confederacy and half the people were on the side of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And you had these guerrilla bands like Quantrill's Raiders and so on and so forth.
Right, Missouri Redlegs, yeah. It was
awful.
Yeah,
and the fighting there was horrific. The civilians were hunted down and slaughtered simply because they were on the wrong side. And the same pattern it will certainly occur here in America if the balloon goes up. And once again, for all the people listening from the Department of Homeland Security, I'm absolutely opposed to this war. I'm trying to give them advice on how to stop it.
Yep.
And how to hold this country together militarily, because if the balloon goes up, they won't be able to put the cats back into the bag. The power will shift. It will shift away from the Bilderbergers and into the hands of 16-year-old gangbangers in L.A. and other places. I don't care about these establishment politicians anymore. They're not even worth listening to. The people I listen to are the 16-year-old gangbangers. I monitor them. That's why I watch programs like Lockup. Maybe
mm-hmm.
you've seen it. It's about our prison system.
Mm-hmm.
And from my perspective, these are not really prisons. They are military academies where these gangs are training the future leaders of Civil War II. And after they get out, they go right back to their gangs
mm-hmm.
and stockpile weapons, and they're getting ready. Some of them are shifting their perspective from merely criminal gangs to a political orientation, especially the Mexicans. Once again, I'm not bad-mouthing Mexicans. That's just the way it is, buddy. I'm
mm-hmm.
sorry it's that way, but that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, my favorite one of those prison shows is I Almost Got Away With It.
Oh, and, yeah.
And, you know, that's the one with the guy in a yellow jumpsuit, and it says, I almost got away with it. And then he leans forward at the waist, you know, and you can tell he's pulling his pants down, and then he disappears, and all you see is the bars. I think that's so funny. It's kind of like, hey, you know, wow, it's just, I don't know, it's pretty nasty, but hey, that's the reality.
I was explaining to this other radio talk show host, if you're a young, unemployed Mexican-American, you can go on welfare, or if you're lucky, you can get a job flipping burgers for a minimum wage, or down the road, you can say, hey, the heck with this crap. I'm a warrior. I won't have to take crap from anybody who's got $5 for the price of a Big Mac. I'll just take my AK-47 and kick down doors and take whatever I want. That's the way a lot of young men think. And when they sense that they can do this, that's precisely what they will do. There's nothing, the most horrible weapon in this world is a 16-year-old with an assault rifle.
Oh,
I
yeah.
saw them in Yugoslavia, and they fight like tigers. They're not afraid of dying. They have no concept of death.
You know what I was taught? I've got a degree in youth leadership, and they taught us demographics. And they said that a 16 to 16-and-a-half-year-old male, he said they think they're going to live forever. They have no fear of death at all. They have no concept of it. So I know what you're saying is true.
Yeah, I mean, most people like me, I'm an old guy. I'm 65 years old. You know,
mm-hmm.
I just mellow out, and I don't have any access to grind. I don't want to stir up trouble. I want to stir it down. But young kids don't think like that. They have no concept of defeat. They're warriors.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know, take your pick, Goss from Germany or whatever, or American Indian warriors.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I pointed out is that these gangs are really warrior cultures. Like in a
mm-hmm.
warrior culture like the Native American Indians, every adult male was a warrior. That was his primary
mm-hmm.
job. Every one of them went around armed, and they didn't take any BS off of anybody.
And a lot of them, they didn't care if the elders didn't want to go to war. You know, Dragon Canoe in 1776, he says, our nation's melting like a snowball in the sun. He said, you can do whatever you want, but I'm going to war. And he declared war against the United States. And he was Tecumseh's father-in-law. He taught Tecumseh everything he knew, and... But the Chickamauga Confederacy had a northern wing and a southern wing. If they had hooked up and controlled the Mississippi River, they would have stopped the American Revolution in its tracks. We were allied with the British. And then Tecumseh almost pulled it off again. He and his brother Tenskwatawa about 10, 15 years later. And Tippecanoe was the end of that.
Yeah.
But that's the problem with Native Americans is the young people get pissed off enough, it doesn't matter. You know, the tradition is you don't go to war unless the women's hearts are on the ground. But, you know, they said, hey, we've had enough of it. And the tradition was is one man couldn't tell another man what he should do, you know. And so it was probably the closest thing to anarchy. People don't know, you know, what anarchy is. It's not people running around throwing bombs. Another good example of what anarchy is Spain after Franco. They had loosely knit confederations of local governments, and they were getting along fine for about 10 years until, you know, Franco brought the Germans in to, you know, as a warm up for World War II.
One other thing I'd like to point out about the social conditions in America, we're transforming ourselves into what I call a warrior culture, not unlike the Native American Indians where all the young males go about armed. Everyone
mm-hmm.
considers himself a warrior. Previously, we had what I would call a citizen-soldier culture where every
American adult male knew that he had a military obligation to his country, but they didn't typically go about armed and shooting each other in some chaotic manner. They knew the federal government was boss, and they just went about their normal civilian lives. It's not like that in a warrior culture. In a warrior culture, all young males are armed, and they're very pugnacious, and they're not inclined to accept any BS from anybody. And it doesn't matter if they got a police uniform and a squad car, they couldn't care less.
Well, and this is the research I did about a year and a half ago. I looked into the history of the old militia system, and what I found out was, you know, back in the 1840s, every state had its own militia laws, and then most of the militias, they just didn't work. You know, it was a laughing stock. The only time they ever coalesced is when we were really at war. But you can go back and you can find the political cartoons, you know, about the Jacksonian period and all the weird stuff that was going on in the militias. And so they more or less disbanded them in the 1850s. And then as the Civil War loomed, they reorganized them. And then here in Tennessee, the State Guard, which was mostly colored, was used to track down the night riders and put down the paramilitary groups like the KKK and others. And they were used as a political tool by the carpetbagger governor at that time. And then in the 1880s, there were militias laws passed here. They tried another model. They established something called volunteer militia companies, and they said, you know, all you have to do is get a bunch of guys together, and you use this exact charter and just fill in the blanks, send it to the Secretary of State, and then you want to build an armory, we'll give you tax-free status for your armory. So they try to do it on a volunteer basis. And at that time, everything was established. All the leaders were elected. They had every county. It was all staggered, so the adjutant general staff could go out and supervise the yearly musters. Every year they got together and elected a captain and other staff officers. And then this one, all these, as you went up the ranks all the way to division level, and there were four divisions in the state, I'm talking two-star generals, the higher you got in the officer ranks, and it was officers and electing officers. And to this day, in the Constitution of the State of Tennessee, it says that if the governor mobilizes the militia, that there will be elections. And nobody has any kind of a concept of how that's to be done unless they go back to the old 1840 militia laws. But what happened in the 1890s when they had the National Guard Enabling Acts, the first National Guard Enabling Act, they dropped one tier of elected officers. In other words, they started imposing leadership from the top down. And then in 1918, they dropped off, they imposed some more level to the point where you know, rather than electing two-star generals, they were down to electing colonels. And then after World War II, that was all gone. So basically, it's between 1885 and 1918, we went from having a colonial militia to having a standing army. And people like Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, he was right in there advocating it. Because it didn't work. We didn't walk up to our responsibilities and we didn't participate in government, and it's our ancestors that gave this away. And nature abhors a vacuum, and the New World Order types walked right in, and you know, and they were directed right out of the city of London. Glenn Beck talked about them on TV all the time. You know, their symbol was, you know, they were hammering the world into and reshaping it.
Okay, I want to break off. I've got to take about a 5 minute break here.
Oh, sure.
And then I'll be back online. I've got to take care of a, a necessary problem, and I'll be right back.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah, no problem. I'll find
Hang
a good
on.
Song.
They have to kill him. They have to kill him. Because they can't break off spirit. We choose directly who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. About power.
That's right. It's about power. It is. And we do have a caller. Caller, have you got a question or comment for Thomas Chittum?
Yeah, this is Jack again. And
hey,
hi,
Jack. I thought that was you.
Yeah, I wanted to apologize to Mr. Chittum because I meant to speak earlier to him and to thank him for his service and to tell him welcome home. Because it's just important for me to share that with the guys like him.
Absolutely. I wish you could have met him. He's a good guy. He really is. He's got a level head, and he's like me. Gets a little excitable.
Well, you know what? What he's talking about is just like it's scary bad, man. It's scary bad, and it makes so much sense. And I just hope somehow we can profit from what he's telling us in some way, in a positive way and not in a negative way. I don't want to see things go down, but if things go down, they will go down. What he's saying is it's the God honest truth. I mean, it exactly. And it's been really weighing on me living out here. You know, I don't have a gun yet, and I'd have to sneak it into the house because my wife is just, you know, she's had enough difficulty with me with my PTSD and stuff, and you know, I've been telling myself I got to get at least a 45 because mm-hmm. I've got to have some kind of stopping power. And,
well, you know, and Tom, we got about 15 minutes left. Tom, you know, why don't you talk about, make some recommendations, and Jack, stay on the line.
Okay.
Tom, what do you recommend people get as far as a weapon?
Okay. Personally, myself, I don't have any firearms whatsoever, and that's the truth. All I got is a machete to take care of burglars. I did write an article called Sergeant Skull's Basic Combat Shooting Course that gets into this. And I talked about three GATs, the M14, the AK-47, and the M16, and about their characteristics. Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm concerned, pistols are a military joke. They're for burglars or for polishing off wounded prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. If you want to get a serious GAT, you should get an assault rifle and one with a scope. In Yugoslavia, the snipers ruled the day. And when I was fighting in the bush in Vietnam, it was so up close and personal that a scope was meaningless because we were fighting a rock throwing range, and the only solution there was an assault rifle. But in a situation like Yugoslavia or here in America, it's typified by. It will be typified by long-distance shooting. There will be many opportunities for snipers because in built-up areas like suburbs, there you can see for typically hundreds of meters. I'm standing on the patio of my apartment right now, and I can see for like 500 meters in one direction and 200 meters in another, and that means sniper country. If you get a GAT, get one with a scope and learn how to use it. And make sure it's a real assault rifle and not a shotgun or a pistol. Those are basically military jokes.
Right.
And I'm sorry to say to all you shotgun fans, but you got it all wrong.
Yeah.
There is no army in the world that is armed with a shotgun as its basic combat weapons because they're basically useless. They all have assault rifles.
Now, the AK-47 effective range is about 300 meters because it's about like a 30-30. It poops out. You know, and the ballistics is good. You know, 30. You know, I'd say if the round wasn't so expensive, everybody ought to have a grand. But you know, with the cost of ammunition, you know, you're recommending, you know, 5,000 rounds of ammo, and I mean, my gosh, AK rounds are up to 19-20 cents a round now, and I mean 30-06. I mean, it was up to. Oh my God! 30 caliber carbine ammo is 50 cents a round. So I figure, well, where do you come down? You know, between the M16 ammo and the Russian short, you know, AK-47 ammo.
Okay, here's my opinion on the AK-47. It's just about the perfect assault rifle for Beavis and Butthead.
Mm-hmm.
It made all the trade-offs just about right. But the problem is, here in America, there are huge stockpiles of military ammunition, and they come in two basic calibers, with the one for the M16 and the one for the M60 machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a GAT, you had better get one that is capable of firing one of these two rounds, unless you have a huge stockpile of ammo for your AK-47.
Mm-hmm.
You'd better have one that can take the cartridges that will be looted from military installations, and that comes down to the M16 round with a 223,
yep.
Or the full NATO round fired by the 308.
Yeah.
An AK-47 is fine if you have a whole shitload of ammunition stored away from it for it, but I wouldn't recommend it. As far as I'm concerned, the AK-47 is the king of assault rifles. It is.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what. I had one of those in Yugoslavia. You pick one up and you feel like you're Tony Montana.
Oh
yeah.
You
can kill anybody within rock throwing range. It is great.
Well, all the special forces guys I knew came back. They all said, "Hey, yeah, we dropped our M16s and we picked up the first AK we could lay our hands on."
Yeah, it's a fine assault rifle. I keep
telling people that an AR-15 is fine if you're a range shooter. I'm not a range shooter. I learned how to shoot with people shooting back at me, and it's a whole different ball game. Your weapon had better be able to keep you alive at the critical distance, which is about rock throwing range, about 30 meters. And at that range, the AK-47 is king. It can turn Beavis and Butthead into a killing machine.
Mm-hmm. You know, they do. They do make on the AK platform. They do make the AK-74. It's chambered for the NATO round. And the problem is lethality went out the window in the early 80s when they changed from the old M92 ball round to the SS-109 XM85 round. They went from 0.8 inch to a little over an inch, and they changed the twist so it had a faster twist, and it stabilized it. It was pitching and yawing. That's the reason why people thought it tumbled. Well, it tumbled when it hit. But they made it more accurate. They made it accurate out to 800 meters, and the Marines loved it. But you know, the lethality just went right out the window. Of course, you know, our government has just bought up 400 million rounds of 40 caliber pistol ammo. So you know, and it's hollow point. So you know what they're getting ready for.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line for me is that I'm not going to get a Gap. But if I were going to get a Gat, the one I would probably get would be the Ruger Mini 14 with the extra heavy barrel.
Mm-hmm.
That
Good
would
choice.
Probably be your best bet, because there's going to be tons of .223 ammunition looted, and you, mm-hmm. if you have any kind of initiative, you should be able to get a good supply of that throughout the entire festivities, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
When I was over in Vietnam, I saw there was one sergeant and my platoon who had an M14, and we'd been out in the bush fighting for several days, and we hadn't had the opportunity to do any maintenance on our rifles, and his M14 was rusted shut. You could not pull back the charging handle with your hand. It was impossible. So what this guy did, he put the butt of the M14 on the ground and stomped down on the charging handle with his boot, and that broke the rust, and the M14 worked just fine. The problem with the M16 is it's a weak piece of junk. It's a cheaper mm-hmm. toy. It breaks easily. You can't do with it what you can do with an M14 or a Ruger Mini 14. They're very sturdy.
Tolerances are too tight on the M16, and you know they're coming out with new generation AKs now where they're isolating the gas operating system away from anywhere where it can pollute the barrel. Back in 1985, I would have said M14 or Mini 14 had been a poor choice, but because they weren't really built for a military campaign. But hey, yeah, I tend to agree with you. And the problem with the M14, you know, it is expensive. I mean, you're talking a lot of money here, you know, so. But the problem with the M14 is they only made 800,000 of them, and the bolts tended to fracture longitudinally. And but the Mini 14's been out for a long time now. They're investment cast, and yeah, I think it's a good choice. Now in California, you know, it's illegal to have anything more than, I guess, a 5-round magazine. And Mini 14 with a scope or a scout rifle or whatever you want to call it, they're low priced. And
yeah, it's a good get all the way around the Mini 14. I had one for a while, but I got rid of it because I decided I'm not going to participate in this. I don't want the Department of Homeland Security to think that I'm stockpiling weapons, because I'm not. All I've got is a machete. That's the literal
yeah.
truth. That's my own personal way of trying to warn people about how terrible this war is going to be. I'm simply not going to participate in any way, shape, or form whatsoever. But if you do intend to, get yourself a Mini 14. That's probably the best trade-off. The M14 is a fine weapon, but it's best left to trained soldiers who can take advantage of its characteristics. Here's my lecture on assault rifles. A good assault rifle has to pass a Beavis and Butthead test. If you can give that assault rifle to Beavis and Butthead and they can maintain it and use it effectively, that's what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the AK-47 has been such a successful weapon throughout its entire history. If you go to any battlefield anywhere in the world and you start looking at the combatants, 90% of them are going to be Beavis and Butthead, drunk, higher and dope, semi-trained, crazy as hell, exhausted from lack of sleep. But yet, if you give one of them an AK-47, all of a sudden they're Tony Montana.
Yeah,
the AR-15 is too fragile. The M-14 is best left to special ops guys who know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They got this new one called, I think it's called the HK-416. I believe you were talking about it a minute ago, that is basically a jam-proof weapon, but we don't have them. We should. They should give them to our military, and it should be rechambered to take the Russian short round, the kind the AK-47 bars.
Yeah.
Everything's a trade-off when it comes to assault rifles. If you get an M-14, you've got a weapon with more stopping power, but yet you can't carry as much ammo. And 99% of the bullets or the rounds fired in combat never hit anything except trees or buildings. They don't hit people. The best way to make the trade-off is with more ammo. And in my opinion, the best trade-off is a Russian short round, as fired by the AK-47.
One other observation. Back in 1994, I believe, federal government passed a law that made it illegal to fire any, they were specific, any military type ammunition, you know, 308, 556, 45, 9mm, on federal lands. Interesting law. And, you know, leaving it, you know, leaving you with, you know, the civilian calibers. And I know guys that have gone south of the border. They could get into Central American, South American countries with a 45 chambered in 38 Super, but you know anything that was military caliber was a no-no. So you're right about trade-offs. You're absolutely right about trade-offs. And being in California, it's kind of a disadvantage, but. You know, if you survive, you'll be picking up, you know, weapons as you go along the way, because when you run out of ammo on one, it becomes a club until you can pick up another one someplace. And anyway, we're getting ready to. We can run over the 2 hours if you want to, and but if you're ready to close, we can go ahead and close, Tom.
Okay, we can go ahead and close in, and maybe in the future you can have me back on again. I'm working on another
sure.
book called Mackinder's War about Halford Mackinder and his battle plan and the overall global picture. That might be interesting.
Sure.
Okay, yep. One other thing. If you will snail mail me your address, I want to send you a $40 contribution because I think your program is a worthy one.
Oh, thank you.
Supported, and I will... encourage all your listeners to do the same thing. So send me your snail mail address, and I'll send you $40 to help keep you on the air.
I will, and thanks a lot. And if it wasn't for Jackson, I wouldn't be on the air anyway. So, but anyway, folks, this has been Prophecy Keepers for tonight. We've got another live interview tomorrow night. And anyway, thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow night.
Okay, thanks for having me on. Bye-bye.
This is Yasa Sagonige. A 7th grade grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. 我需要确确确认 You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
Let's